Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with my co-hosts, Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky.
Hey there.
Hello.
This week, Evan talked to John Mooallem.
He has written for the New York Times Magazine for a long time. He's also written for Harper's. He's also written for a bunch of other places, Slate, you name it. But one of the things to know about this interview is that John Mooallem is not the kind of person that talks about himself a lot. So I got him to do this, and he has some very insightful things to say about reporting and his process, and actually it's really fascinating, things I'd never talked to him about before. But he's not a guy that sort of trumpets what he does. And I personally, besides being his friend, I think that his sort of collection of pieces is really fascinating and diverse.
If he's got that humbleness, perhaps you guys did not talk about the fact that he hit the long form triple crown last year. He's the only person I know of who he wrote this incredible story about the origins of the high five, and it ran in ESPN the magazine. They did a version of it on Radiolab, and then he also did a version of it for Pop-Up magazine. So he did a live version on stage, which has got to be the only three-peat ever for a story, I say.
Thanks for listening.
I'm here with John Mooallem for the new episode of the Longform Podcast. John is in San Francisco. John, please describe the audio setup that is involved in you speaking to me right now.
Right now, I'm sitting in a kitchen. I'm sitting in Doug McGray's kitchen. Doug McGray being a mutual friend of ours and the editor-in-chief of Pop-Up magazine, and we've got a microphone propped up on a empty egg carton on top of a wallet on top of a small ramekin kind of holstered in a folded copy of today's New York Times.
It's what all the pros use. You can actually buy that setup at some of the higher-end audio shops. You don't have to make it yourself.
Right, right. But we didn't want to leave anything to chance, so we wanted to make sure it was done just to our specs.
So we know each other from many things, but perhaps the most interesting of which is that we shared an office, which I bring at the beginning because my recollection of when we shared an office was that every time I looked over in your office, you were diligently finishing another story. And every time I looked around my office, I was reading soccer news or talking on the phone with some random person that had nothing to do with reporting. So
that's a really flattering memory of it. I don't quite know that it's true. My memory of our offices was that yours had lots of framed pictures and a little Hunter S. Thompson shrine on the fireplace mantle and a banjo and rugs, and mine had a silver metal table and a mostly empty bookshelf, and that was sort of it, and a chair.
That's because you were oriented around getting things done, and I was oriented around making my office look like a place where people got things done or did interesting things. Neither of which was true.
I don't know. I mean, this is revisionist, I think, but I'll accept your telling of it. Yes, I'm the uber productive, almost ascetic, monastic reporter, writer, who needs nothing but a metal table. And even that was your metal table, as I recall. It wasn't even my table.
Yeah, I don't think I ever got it back.
No.
So let's talk about that. How do you go about your sort of process? I mean, you're a full-time freelancer. How long have you been a full-time freelancer? I mean, your whole career, basically.
Yeah, I mean, since 2006, I've been doing this. I was in school before that. I went to the Berkeley Journalism School for 2 years prior, so starting in 2004. And I'd done some freelancing before that. But when I got out of school, I had, I had the good fortune of doing a story for the Times Magazine while I was still in grad school. That was actually my thesis or dissertation. I don't remember what they call it.
Which story was that? And
this was a story about the pre-sliced apple business.
That was the story you did in grad school, the pre-sliced apple story?
Yeah, yeah. That was in early 2006, I guess. And yeah, I should explain. Just this was a company basically that was cutting up apples, putting this magical solution on them so they wouldn't turn brown, and putting them in little baggies and trying to sell them in a way that was more convenient, that they could be eaten, you know, on the go, quote unquote. So it was sort of a business story about this company, but then also sort of a journey into this whole trend of making food easier to eat, and why Americans are too busy to eat a whole apple as opposed to sliced apples and things like that.
Well, that kind of gets to what I was trying to ask about your process, in that you have certain stories. I feel like there's different categories of types of stories that you do, but there's one category that I think of as sort of delving into some aspect of life or society that we sort of, everyone encounters every day, but you don't really stop to think about. And then when you start burrowing into that area, you find this entire world behind it. And the sliced apples were kind of like that. Like, everyone sees these sliced apples and sort of says, oh yeah, of course, sliced apple snacks, fresh apples, you can just buy those. But do you have this like Seinfeldian like approach where you're sort of like, what about that? Or like, how does that kind of story come about?
Yeah, well, I guess it sort of is Seinfeldian, or maybe like in Crab Your Moments, like Andy Rooney-esque. with the apple thing, it was sort of interesting actually, because I tend to approach, I think you're right. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily have thought to explain it that way, but I think there is a certain kind of story that I've done where there's kind of two parts. There's a front story of people doing things in real time, you know, in this case, an executive trying to launch a pre-sliced apple company. And then there's sort of all this secondary material that kind of gives the story the heft and the curiosity that will sustain it for, you know, 5,000 words in that case. And in that case, you know, it really just started to be this, you know, I found all these really bizarre studies about, you know, how people eat and where they're eating, you know, percentage of meals people eat in cars, and then all these other attempts by other segments of the food industry to make their products more grabbable or grab and go. And it really became a story about, you know, kind of contemporary American eating habits and also just kind of laziness. You know, I mean, I don't say that in a judgmental way, but just the, you know, why exert the effort to cut up an apple for your kid and put it in a bag with some lemon juice if someone's selling that to you and right. You can afford it. So I tend to think of the stories in those two parts, and often I'll just have a running list of kind, you know, two side by side running lists of some of these things. You know, oh, here's the company making these apples, that struck my curiosity, but maybe I can't exactly explain why. And then I'll have another list, like, you know, I've noticed a lot of, you know, convenience foods, you know, what's that all about? And it's a matter of just keeping kind of enough of those things running in my head, or just even written down in a computer file until they start to link up. And uh-huh. I see, you know, oh, if I tell the story about this apple company, it's a way to talk about, you know, this whole other subject matter. So kind of, you know, you've got the story and the subject finally syncing up. I mean, in that case, it had actually been, I just started reporting about all these convenience foods, just, you know, gathering string and just trying to, you know, reading all these weird food technology journals and all these Herculean efforts to make, you know, grabbable macaroni and cheese, like macaroni and cheese that you could pick up and eat in a car, and just all these bizarre things. But I never really found one that was a real narrative, or that had a character that I could run with, until I stumbled across the apple guys. And there was something just so elemental about an apple, which seemed to make the story even more compelling. I mean, here was a food that seemed pretty convenient to begin with. So it's not, you know, it's not, I don't really get these aha moments where I find, you know, I was just listening to your podcast with David Grand, and he talks about finding the, you know, the perfect squid hunter. And I don't always have that. You know, I may find the perfect apple guy, but I don't really know what he's perfect for right away. And the real kind of thrilling aha moments for me always come when I realize where that guy can take you, or how to get to something that I'm already looking at.
And do you feel like you kind of know that person when you encounter them, like that you're sort of cycling through making calls and things, and then you sort of hit the person with the right level of enthusiasm?
Sometimes. I mean, I think it depends on what the story is. I mean, I think people are always much more inherently interesting than they will come across, you know, in one phone call as being. So, you know, I don't always think that the people I'm talking to are these fantastically, you know, larger than life people, or that they're, you know, going to say really wonderfully introspective philosophical things. But then, you know, when you spend a certain amount of time with someone, you start to see those other sides. But, you know, some people right off the bat are fantastic sources on the phone, or fantastic characters, and you know just right away that you want to go and spend time with them. Some people are too fantastic. You know, some people are so eager to say these quotable, meaningful things for you that they're almost hard to talk to, you know, hard to get through a linear conversation with. So that's its own danger, I think.
Well, there are these moments. So as you'll see, I'm a close reader of the Mualim catalog, but I feel like there's like a spot in a lot of stories where you drop in maybe a one sentence or two sentence quote from someone that sort of, it almost like represents their enthusiasm for whatever it is that they're doing. And I wanted to ask you about it because it can be, I have the feeling that it can be read, it always reads funny to me, like the mattress guy. You did this story about mattresses for the New York Times Magazine and mattress salesman and sort of sleep technology. And there's a mattress guy executive in there who comes in and immediately in this booming voice says, you know, how did you sleep last night? And that's like his shtick, which to me read very funny. But I kind of imagine that if the subject reads it, they would not think you were making fun of them. They would just think, oh, yeah, that's me. That's my thing. But how do you view those?
Yeah, you know, I actually think about that a lot. I mean, I definitely don't, you know, I don't see myself as making fun of people at all. I mean, I guess I have had conversations with people like that where I understand that sometimes things can be read that way. You know, that's sort of a peculiar example that you pointed out, because this guy was a marketer. His name was Pete Bills. I think that was how you pronounced it. He worked at Select Comfort, which is the company that has the bed that you can pump up, you know, on either side, so it's the perfect firmness or softness. And he was their director of marketing, but he had this fascination with sleep science. And that story really, you know, that's the perfect example of what we were just talking about, where it was a story about the mattress industry trying to bring some science and empiricism into what they do and convince you that they could provide a better night's sleep so that they could compete with sleeping pill companies. But it really also became a story about, you know, how people think about sleep and how we're sort of all aspiring for, you know, the beautiful 8 hour, you know, out like a rock kind of sleep. And maybe that's not actually, you know, the way our biology is designed. So you had those two halves, and in his, you know, I was originally, I think, I don't remember it entirely, but I remember being originally a little put off by him, you know, just in terms of how useful he'd be as a source, because he was so over the top. I mean, literally we went out to lunch and he asked the waiter, you know, how'd you sleep last night? And it was all he wanted to talk about. And I couldn't understand, you know, I sort of thought, well, some of this has to be a performance for me, but we were also with a lot of his coworkers and they sort of rolled their eyes, you know, as if to say, old Pete, you know, at it again, you know? So that was a case where I almost felt like he was that sort of person where it was almost too unreal. And that there wasn't going to be much genuine there, excuse me. But then as I got deeper into the story and I realized, well, this is really, he's really just an exaggerated example of everything I'm seeing in the mattress industry, where they're just really clamoring for some kind of edge, something that's going to make them look a little more, you know, scientific or a little more, you know, legitimate, for lack of a better word, now that they're up against actual science. I mean, they're competing in a marketplace for sleep with doctors, and drug companies, and all they have is this kind of placebo effect where they can assure you that, you know, their device is so comfortable that it will lull you into a different realm. And his, to what degree it was performative or not, his whole demeanor was designed to sell that idea, that he was on the job and he had this, you know, laboratory approach to what he was doing. So in that case, I just sort of ran with it, knowing full well that you know, maybe it would be funny, or maybe, you know, people might read it as a little belittling to him, but that was in fact the image that he was very carefully trying to put out there.
Yeah.
And that it actually had a resonance with the rest of the story. It wasn't just, you know, because he was funny that I should include all this stuff. It was actually like a stand-in for his entire industry.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're almost like a generalist in the extreme. If I try to look through your pieces and find a common thread, it's more actually about a style of story, like with those two parts. Like I can see that in different stories, but do you think of yourself as writing a certain type of story or a genre, or do they all fit together somehow?
You know, I don't really know. You're pretty much of a generalist too, I'd say. I mean, I don't think it's as uncommon as people make it sound sometimes. Maybe I'm being naive. I don't know. Can I ask you, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I always want to be a generalist, but I feel like I got stuck writing about certain types of technology and things, and I was like working to get out of that. So for me, it was like working to get out of a beat in a way, as opposed to just saying, here is the world, and I will write about it, its most interesting aspects to me. It was more like, how can I connect this to things I've done before, but gradually move away from the types of pieces I was doing to ones that I would rather be doing.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think I had, just being a freelancer, I think I just found that it was, if I found something I wanted to do, I had to jump on it and try to do it. And I guess I can't explain why the subjects were so varied. I mean, I guess that's just, and we all read about lots of different things every day.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I've been working on this book for the last 2 years, basically all about, you know, wildlife and conservation and, kind of cultural perceptions of animals. And that's that, it's definitely felt like I've, you know, obviously I've been in that pretty deep in that world.
And that originated out of Times Magazine story, right? Or at least part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of originated out of a couple different stories. I had done one about this reintroduction project where they're trying to bring whooping cranes back to the U.S. and it's just this completely over the top enterprise where they've got these guys, you know, teaching whooping cranes to fly behind these airplanes and things. And that really kind of opened my eyes about just how involved humanity has to be to keep these animals around. And then shortly after that, I did this story for the magazine about perceptions and of, you know, quote unquote gay animals, like all these various studies that had come out showing animals of the same sexes mating in the wild or, you know, co-parenting, I guess you'd say, and how that all those studies tended to get politicized when they'd get into the media.
That story, first of all, had probably the cutest New York Times Magazine story cover that's ever been made.
It was unbelievable. Yeah, it was a Jeff Koons shot all these animal couples, which was it was incredible, and it was right on Easter weekend too, which I didn't really put together until just like the day I saw the magazine. But it came out on Easter Sunday, and there was some bunnies on the cover.
And wasn't the title just "Can Animals Be Gay?" Question mark.
I think it was something. Yeah, like I don't remember. That was, I think that might have been the title online, and then they had a different cover line on the, I think it maybe just said "They Gay" somewhere. That was one of the, or maybe I'm reversing those, but yeah, it was. They packaged it pretty well, I thought.
So those two stories kind of pushed you into thinking more about how we interact with wildlife, how we interact with animals, and that kind of prompted the book, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whooping crane story got me thinking, you know, in a very literal scientific way, you know, what are we actually doing to keep endangered species surviving? And it was much more elaborate and, you know, innovative and wacky than I would have ever suspected. And then the gay animal story really got me thinking of, you know, what, there's all these things just living on Earth out there. And we kind of all talk about them or see clips of them on YouTube or whatever, but it's they tend to be really easy things to argue about or have these kind of far-fetched ideas about. And so I've kind of combined those two things in the book. So I've got, I guess it's the same, again, the same structure. I guess I'm just repeating myself. I haven't realized until now, but the same kind of structure where you've got stories of people, conservationists on the ground, you know, often amateur conservationists just kind of doing anything they can to help certain animals. And then this kind of, you know, B sections or more essayistic or historical parts, you know, I've got a whole thing about the history of the teddy bear and how opinions of different animals have changed in the U.S. over time. So again, it's sort of slamming those two things together and letting the details from the, you know, the firsthand kind of on the ground reporting, just looking for ways that, that places that that reporting is going to open out into some of these larger questions or have parallels with, you know, histories, you know, on similar or related subjects, and just trying to draw all these lines between them. And then hopefully when you get it all down, making it that it's not too overwhelming and not too all over the place. And mm-hmm. that's, I think, always the really tough part.
And that all happens, in this story that you have in this week's, or maybe it'll be last week's by the time we, put this out, but New York Times Magazine, about, a monkey. So just give a little brief of what that story is about. First, I'm interested in how you found that one and then, and what it's kind of like basically about.
Right. So the story is, based basically around this. There's a rhesus macaque, which is a species of monkey that has been living on the loose in the greater Tampa Bay area since at least 2009, January 2009. And so the story basically tracks the movements of this monkey. But what happened over time is as the State Wildlife Agency and other law enforcement agencies tried to capture the monkey because they were afraid that it was a hazard to people.
Disease? There was
a groundswell of populist sympathy for the monkey, and it became known as the mystery macaque of Tampa Bay, or the mystery monkey. And there were, you know, T-shirts, and there were drinks named after it at resorts, and, you know, everything. Facebook page, of course. And so basically, you know, I just wanted to tell the story of this monkey and also the story of the people who were trying to capture it and why they were trying to capture it. And that was sort of all I knew going in. And I had this sense that just from reading some of the local media coverage that it really was, I don't want to say a parable, because that means that there's sort of an exact, you know, one-to-one correlation between these two things. But there was a relationship between the way the public saw and talked about the monkey and kind of the larger political discourse right now. You know, they wanted the monkey to be free. They didn't want this wasteful, bungling, you know, overreaching government to take it away and lock it up. And it was this real weird, hazy debate about rights going on underneath the story of this monkey. And that was kind of all I knew going in.
And did you think of it going in? Did you have that theme going in, that it was about freedom, that you'd sort of sense that in it? Or was that more when you started talking to people, you realized these people have set this monkey up as basically an example of in some way, you know, what's happening in society, and the monkey should be allowed to do what it wants, and big government shouldn't be shutting down this monkey's life, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'll say a couple things about that. Yes, I was onto that going in. And I think the only reason that I pitched the story now is because suddenly with the RNC happening in Tampa, it seemed like this last piece, everything had just fallen together where you could do a story like that. Because, I mean, frankly, the monkey hasn't really been, you know, the heyday of monkey mania in the Tampa Bay area is long over. I mean, the monkey's still spotted, but it's not really, it's not as big of a cause right now as it was, you know, say a year ago or even 2 years ago. I mean, it's been going on forever. And that's, you know, we can get to that too, but that's sort of part of what the story became about. But so there wasn't really a clear justification to the story right now, except that if you could tease out these political parallels and do it, you know, right before the convention, it seemed like that would be an interesting way in. So that was my thought, but I really didn't, and I may have pitched it, you know, leaning pretty exclusively on that, but I really didn't think that's all it would be. You know, I thought, especially just coming out of the book, I saw all these really interesting kind of issues about, you know, wildlife and invasive, you know, the monkey is a quote unquote invasive species, but of course, Florida is filled with invasive species. And there was all these really interesting kind of ecological issues and the way we categorize these animals. And in the end, I just didn't really even get to a lot of that, because when I got there and the things people were telling me, the political aspect of the story just became so unavoidable. I mean, everywhere I went, people were talking, bring up, you know, out of the blue, things, complaints about the government, or, you know, just, it, I don't know why, you know, I thought I would have to prod these things, you know, prod people for these things, but that really, it just became unstoppable.
Now, when you were going down to do the reporting, did you have a sense that you had to see this monkey, you had to encounter this monkey in order for this to work? Or that if you never saw the monkey, you could kind of do a ride around of the monkey?
I don't really remember. I mean, I can't imagine that I would have thought I had to see the monkey, absolutely, or there'd be no story, because I just don't think I would do the story then. I'm really conservative in terms of, you know, how comfortable I need to feel before I'll go do a story. I mean, I'm just kind of like a wimp in that way. I want to make sure that there's nothing that could just go so wrong that the entire project would be derailed.
So you don't like going and sort of waiting for like one thing that needs to absolutely happen to make this work? Because I feel like I've done several stories like that. It's
yeah, which
one? Incredibly nerve-wracking. When I went to Africa to write about bushmeat hunters,
uh-huh.
And I had sort of one chance to go out with a bushmeat hunter. And it was sort of like, if this guy doesn't actually shoot anything, then I'm going to have the story of sort of like running around in the jungle doing nothing, which is, it wasn't so much that it would completely kill the story, but it was more like, there'd be no lead. Like there'd be nothing. It would just seem really empty if there was no actual like killing of an animal in the thing. So I was like desperately hoping that he eventually killed a bird. So.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So I'm going to say something that might completely contradict what I just said, but I guess you just helped me think of it in a new way. I would say I'm very conservative in terms of, you know, getting the guts up to go do this stuff, and wanting to make sure there's a good chance of success. But I guess I'm a little more liberal in terms of telling myself what I need to do the story. So for example, you know, and I think the book helped with that a lot too. I mean, you just, at least for me, I mean, doing a book, I just went down so many wrong, you know, dark alleys of reporting and took so many wrong turns of just gathered stuff that I'll just never have a hope of ever using.
Mm-hmm.
That it sort of weirdly that also made me feel better about not getting certain things, you know, that you just sort of develop a faith that if you're in the right place and you're asking the right questions, that you'll get enough. And I think that's, you know, probably someone who's been doing this a lot longer than me will have come to that realization, you know, before, but maybe it's just a matter of doing more reporting and then building up that sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I did this story for the Times about right during the BP oil spill in 2010. And I think that was a real lesson for me, because it was about these volunteers who were digging up sea turtle nests and then moving them to Florida. So they're digging them up in Alabama, where there's a lot of oil in the water, and they're moving the turtle eggs to Florida so that when the turtle eggs hatch, the hatchlings won't be basically swimming to their deaths into a huge oil spill.
Yeah, you know, like moving them in trucks, pickup trucks.
Yes, they're moving them in FedEx trucks.
FedEx trucks.
And I went to Alabama, and I thought that the morning after I got there, they'd be digging up a nest. And for some reason that didn't end up happening, or it happened maybe while I was flying there, something had gone wrong. And I ended up spending, I think, even more than a week there, or maybe a week, waiting for the next one, because they can only dig them up at a certain point in the hatchling's gestation, and it was all very complicated. So the next one wasn't for like another week. And I spent just this week in the Gulf Coast of Alabama. I mean, it wasn't so bad, and then in the end, when I saw them dig up a nest, it was kind of a nothing event, and I didn't even use it. And instead, I just described, I kind of recreated, you know, very briefly in like maybe a paragraph or two, digging up the first nest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that also kind of taught me. I mean, I don't know, to be honest, I would probably do it the same way again. I would probably just, you know, put myself out and my family out to because I'd be so anxious and feel like I needed that scene. But I think it does, just having experiences like that has given me some amount of confidence that, you know, there's so many different ways to write a story that if you have enough stuff, you know, enough stuff can come in very different forms. And there's really very rarely something that needs to happen to make or break the story.
And you, in this story, well, I should say, in most of your pieces, I find that you're in there somewhere. Like, you, not quite as a character, but there's you definitely drop in as sort of like, you know, she told me, or a little aside that sort of shows your presence. And that's even more true in this piece. I think there's a whole section really of sort of you at the hotel or motel, sort of thinking about what you've seen, and you've been listening to talk radio, and you're sort of like trying to put together all these ideas about what is this monkey about, what is the chase for this monkey about, and the sightings. Is that something that you intend to do usually, that, or is that something that happens as a natural product of your writing that you feel comfortable putting yourself in, or is that a device?
Well, I mean, this particular monkey story is a huge kind of leap out of left field, I think, in terms of what we're talking about. I mean, I've never been in a story to this degree, I guess. And so maybe I'll just say something about that first. I mean, I think part of that, there's a few things at work, some of them probably not so interesting. You know, one is just just the book. I'm definitely more in the book because I feel like on some level you have to be when you're writing something that long. So I guess I'm a little more comfortable than I used to be. Part of it was, you know, a lot of what I was reporting about had happened a long time ago. You know, I mean, relatively speaking, it wasn't stuff that I was witnessing firsthand. And so I felt like some of the story was going to rest on how I told the information and, you know, kind of how I framed it. You know, I also just kind of saw a cool opportunity. I mean, I was reading Planet of the Apes while I was there. I did it because I thought it would just be funny to be reading Planet of the Apes while I was talking to all these people about a monkey. But then it turned out to just kind of be this bizarre way. I mean, I guess because I just kept going to talking to people about this monkey, and especially the wild monkeys in Ocala. And people were telling me just the most, I mean, they were almost impossible to believe things they were telling about these monkeys, but they were very reputable people telling them to me. And there was this...
Like what kind of things?
This guy, Captain Tom, I don't think this wasn't in the story, but, you know, this guy, Captain Tom, who runs tours on the river. I mean, he was telling me all these things where I remember being on the boat with him, thinking it through, and he's telling me about monkeys sort of attacking people and grabbing the paddles away from kayakers, like jumping on kayaks and grabbing the paddles away. And he's saying these things to me, and I'm thinking he's clearly making this up, or he's exaggerating, because he's a businessman and he wants to sell, you know, tours on the river. And then I thought, this wouldn't help him sell tours on the river. This is terrifying. You know, he had this story about a monkey coming onto his boat trying to get a loaf of bread he had left on the back of the boat, and how he approached the monkey with this big, you know, rod, like this big, like one of these pole boat rods. And the monkey just stood there and huffed at him and stood its ground, you know? and so I felt myself actually becoming a little paranoid. I mean, I think that's another, it's probably a weakness, but, you know, when I go report these stories, I get so wrapped up in them, and I tend to just believe what people tell me initially. You know, I'm so absorbed in what they're saying that I just believe it, and then I have to think about it more critically later. That night, when, you know, before I went to the hotel, I'd been driving around all day and on this boat, and so I just went for a walk, even though it was, you know, so I'm walking in the rain behind this, like, in Home Depot or something by the hotel, just trying to move my legs a bit, and I felt myself actually looking in the trees, like, to make sure there weren't monkeys around, you know. So the whole section where it's you know, a lot of I this, I that, and I'm reading Planet of the Apes, I mean, I just felt like it was the only way to kind of snap back to reality, you know, after hearing all these semi hard to believe, semi-paranoid making details, that let's just take that as far as it goes, you know, let's take it to the science fiction universe. So I think, you know, I didn't have an agenda to, like, write a more, you know, first person type of story or anything. Yeah, I don't really like reading a lot of that stuff, but it just seemed like the best way to approach this, the best thing that I could add to the material at that point, I guess.
But more generally, outside of this story, do you try to keep yourself out to a certain extent, or do you sort of...
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, it's funny that you say, like, you know, you mentioned, like, people will say, she told me. I mean, I'll do things like that. To me, that's not a huge distraction. It's just a way of not always saying, he said, she said, he said, she said. So I think there's maybe, you know, in the writing I like most from people, I think there's you get a sense of a sensibility of the teller of the story, but you aren't necessarily talked at. They're not saying, and then I thought about this, and I thought about that. But I think it's, you know, it's a legitimate, I have no problems with that kind of writing. I think it's just a stylistic, you know, or an aesthetic preference. So I think, you know, you're always going to come across in a magazine story just because it's you who's organizing the material and, you know, asking particular questions and not others, or making leaps from one subject to another. And I guess that's, I hope that's mostly what the things I've done read like,
yeah.
As opposed to, I mean, I think I'm also just really insecure. I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to be the person writing about themselves, you know. It seems like, I mean, I like a lot of people that do that, but I just don't see myself as warranting that kind of attention, or, you know, I don't know. I don't want to tax people by telling them all my feelings, you know?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking of it like a sort of like objectivity issue or whether it's like really gonzo or something. I just get the feeling like when I read a piece of yours, it's sort of like I'm along with this sort of like somewhat quizzical traveler into this place. Like you did this story for the Times Magazine about this comedian, like the most popular comedian in America that like no one in, you know, the East Coast or West Coast has ever heard of, because he does like puppet things in middle America. And there was this section where he's talking about sort of like he found his favorite like dummy from when he was growing up that he had seen, and he's like restoring it.
Right, right.
And he says, like, he's talking about when he's a kid, he says, I think, man, I just want to go see him. And the fact that I'm standing here fixing him up right now is too wacky. And then the next line is just, it was wacky, which is kind of like you just sort of like stepping back for 1 second and saying, like, here's you, the reader, and myself, like, alongside this kind of ridiculous guy. And like, isn't this funny? I just feel like there's a way in which having yourself in there at these different points, besides just making it easier than saying he said, she said, it kind of makes it feel like you're on the same side as the reader. I don't know, to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought about it to this degree, but I mean, that would be great if that's the effect, you know? I mean, I think in that case, if I'm remembering correctly, that the, you know, a line or two after it was wacky is the fact that he's having this very intimate encounter with this childhood dummy and paying very close attention to whether the eyebrows are bushy enough and whatnot. And we're actually sitting on his mammoth luxurious tour bus in a parking lot outside this arena that he's just sold out, with people outside the bus chanting his name.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think to be able to zoom in and zoom out and tell stories in that kind of way automatically conveys some sense of the person who's making all those choices. I mean, obviously no one reads these things as carefully as you and I do. I mean, no one, you know, I don't think the average Sunday Times Magazine reader is going to pick up on something like that, but maybe just subliminally over time. I don't know. I mean, I think like Nick Palmgarten and Ben McGrath, I think are like two really good examples of that too, where, I mean, I love both those writers, and I think that they do that really well, where you can tell that they're in command of this material and they're picking and choosing things they want to show you. But they sort of disappear as narrators, you know, as human beings anyway. I mean, they're a voice, but they're not, you don't need to know anything about them.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't need to know, yeah, their own biography. You just need to sort of trust that they're showing you what is important to see in some way.
Right. Right. Right.
And how do you like to work with editors? I've had the privilege of working with you as your editor, although it's a little bit of an unusual situation because it's for Pop-Up Magazine, which is a live thing. So I have some experience in how you interact with editors, but do you work really closely with your editor, develop a story all the way along, or do you try to just get it to a point and get it to them and get feedback? What's your kind of approach?
Yeah, I mean, to be totally honest, this is the kind of question that I get really terrified about answering in public, because I just don't, I mean, I've never really felt like I knew what I was doing. I've never worked at a magazine really. I mean, I've interned at one, but, and it's only been in the last probably a year or two. I mean, basically when we started sharing that office was when I began to meet a lot of other magazine writers. So I'm always afraid that I'm going to say something about how I operate that's just completely, you know, laughable or something. But I mean, I think again, it's I don't want to go to the editor unless it's absolutely necessary. And I think part of that just kind of comes from basic insecurity. Like I want them to feel like I've got it all under control and they don't need to worry about it until they do. So
I would say that's pretty much what they want also.
Yeah. I think they appreciate not being bothered. So yeah, I mean, I think being easy to work with is a huge asset. I mean, I hope at least, otherwise I've been, you know, sweating at night for no reason, but yeah, I mean, I'll pitch the story and usually, especially with folks at the Times, I mean, now I'm working with a new editor there for the first time. But when I had a really good working relationship with the editors, it would just be, you know, we'd be both very clear from the outset, you know, how I was going to go forward. And then they just wouldn't hear from me until I turned it in. So I don't, yeah, I mean, I have, you know, people I can ask for help that aren't my editor, if I need it sometimes. And it's not too elaborate of a process, I hope.
So that actually, you saying that you've never worked at a magazine sort of reminds me that I know that you went to Berkeley journalism school and we met sometime after that, but how did you decide to begin with to sort of pursue journalism at all?
Because this is the origin story. So I was bit by this radioactive spider.
But weren't you like a butcher at some point?
Yeah, I was a butcher. That was in like one bio long ago, and it seems to have been. It's like you can't Google me without finding that. Yeah. So basically, I was. I graduated from college in 2000, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my father actually died like three weeks. He went into the hospital. He had cancer, and he went into the hospital like a couple days after I got home from college, and then he passed away about 3 weeks later. Oh. So on top of the ordinary disorientation of being like a recent liberal arts grad with no actual career prospects, then there was this whole other level of existential disorientation. Mm-hmm. And I'd been writing, but not any journalism. But was sort of always interested in journalism, but never from any real experience with it. I mean, to be honest, I didn't even really read too many magazines when I was in college. I would read nonfiction books, but you know, I don't think I subscribed to a single magazine in college, or even probably knew what some of the bigger ones were, which is kind of humiliating, I guess. But I managed to get a degree anyway, and so I wound up in New York eventually, working for a literary magazine, just like a literary quarterly called the Hudson Review, where I was just, you know, there was a 3-person staff, and we're publishing a lot of poetry and kind of very highbrow, inside baseball kind of criticism about Alan Tate and, you know, Yates and things like that.
Yeah. The highest of highbrow.
Yes. Yes. So brows I had never even glimpsed before. They were so high. And it was really there that I started reading a lot of magazines. You know, we had subscriptions to Harper's and the New Yorker, and all these things were just laying around. And I remember just reading like a few pieces in Harper's and just being completely blown away and really feeling like I wanted to do that. That all along, the, you know, I'd had a kind of urge to write about things, but I couldn't make them up in a satisfying way. You know, I couldn't make up things that were fun to write about or that, you know, scratch whatever itch I had, and that you could actually go out and talk to other human beings and write about them. And then that solved that entire problem. Mm-hmm. So I got interested in that and just started trying to do some freelancing and did a couple really small things and then some slightly, you know, I did something for Salon. That was kind of like the big, my big first, you know, thing that anyone had heard of, and something for the Village Voice. And then I linked up with this Canadian magazine, which kind of still exists, but not in the same iteration really, called Maison Neuve, which was based out of Montreal. Yeah. And they were just letting me go write these stories, you know, really long stories about the most peculiar, kind of not even really worthy subjects. And I'd be curious to read some of those now, because I'm sure they kind of all feel too long. But that was when I really kind of got some experience at writing magazine pieces. And it was shortly after that that my girlfriend, now wife, who was living with me in New York, was coming to the Bay Area for grad school. So so we were moving out, and I kind of I applied to Berkeley let's see what happens. I didn't go around looking for journalism schools, but then when I got accepted and visited the place, it seemed like too good of an opportunity to pass up. I mean, it was really just a luxury to get to go there at that time.
And then how did you publish that Times Magazine piece while you were there? Or you wrote it while you were there and you published it later? Or did it actually come out while you were in journalism school?
No, it actually came out when I was in journalism school. I'd also done I did a piece for Harper's when I was there first. And then I actually did a Talk of the Town piece. And then I did the Times Magazine piece. So I basically never stopped freelancing. I mean, I was starting to get some real momentum freelancing when I left New York. And I treated Berkeley almost like a think tank or something, you know, a place where I could go and I would still be doing exactly what I was doing. But now I had these people to go to for advice, and I had the comfortable feeling of being part of some, you know, community of striving kids, and we were all in it together. And I was really actively trying to get the kind of experience and connections that would give me the faith to make a go of freelancing once I left. Because I didn't really think I was going to be cut out for anything else. I was really terrible at newspaper writing and reporting. I tried to get, you have to do an internship in between your 2 years at Berkeley. And I just kept trying to get these newspaper internships, and I just couldn't get a single one. And people, you know, these recruiters would come and my tie would be crooked, or, you know, I would just, like, I had my resume was formatted incorrectly, and just really, it was really embarrassing, you know? And just, I couldn't get one of these jobs. I couldn't get one of these internships for the summer. You know, many of them were unpaid.
That's nuts.
And then, so I just felt like, well, it's going to be me on my own or nothing, you know?
Yeah, well, so much magazine freelancing, I feel like it's driven by fear. Like,
right.
It's just, there's fear over your income. There's fear over the fact that you don't have any other skills. And then there's a fear at a certain age. You're sort of like, well, now I can't keep saying I'll go to law school if this doesn't work out. Like, it's pretty much all you got.
Right. I think I'm just getting to that age now, actually, where, I'm sort of realizing that this is going to be it for a while. So, yeah, I think you're right. It is. I mean, so much of both the lifestyle and then the ability to be the least bit successful at this, I think, is just as much emotional and constitutional, you know, about your own constitution as it is about any real skill set. Because you just have to be able to keep this whole other layer of anxiety and issues that have nothing to do with the actual work. You have to be able to keep it relatively calm enough to be able to sit down and get anything done.
And how do you look at sort of other writers or read other magazines? Because I always thought one of the hardest things was, even if you're not a sort of really competitive person or a person who gets jealous of other people, if you are writing feature stories for magazines, every week and every month there's, you know, 50 examples of people doing what you're doing in a very public way.
Yeah, better.
That you can read and say, oh, shit. In fact, the only thing that I remember about that I knew about you before I met you was that our mutual friend Jen Kahn said, you got to meet this guy John, he's great, and he's doing all these stories, like, he's still in journalism school, and you should read the story in Harper's. And I read them, and I can distinctly remember thinking, like, who is this guy, why is it, this isn't fair. this is a topic I could have written on, but I can't write like that.
Yeah, that's just the way we live, isn't it? I mean, that happens to me 3 to 4 times a week at least. And with Twitter, it's so much worse, you know, because it's not just, I mean, the stuff is just constantly flashing at you.
Yeah, even the old stuff.
Right, right. All times are just crunched. It's, you know, it's like now you're competing against, like, you know, Tom Wolfe in the 70s. So, yeah, I don't know. You're asking me how to deal with that. I have no idea.
How do you manage that?
Yeah, I have no idea. How do you manage that?
Well, I by getting to know people, that was the main way, because I think if for me, if I was sitting alone in my apartment, my tiny apartment that I could barely afford, and staring at the computer, and then all these magazines are coming in the mail, and I'm thinking, like, who the fuck are these people? And there's just more of them all the time, and God, they seem annoying. And then if I met them, I would think, oh, this person's amazing. And I think that was what really changed it for me. I got started getting to know magazine writers, and the ones that you're annoyed by their success, you realize, like, first of all, they're also very insecure, and second of all, they're really nice people who are just trying as hard as you are. So that
right.
was, that's been
well. I'm gonna back up. I wouldn't say you seem a little more vindictive, and I'm not annoyed by these things. I just want to kind of scrunch up into a ball and hide. So you seem to have a lot more aggression to work through about this subject. But
I have both.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said though, because I've always felt like, you know, whenever you talk to people about this, they always want to know what's it like living on the West Coast as opposed to in New York and doing this work. And I've always clung to the idea, perhaps fraudulently, that there's a benefit to living away from the center of publishing because you're not constantly running into these people. You don't have to constantly measure yourself against, other people. And I think that there's some truth to that, but I also think that what you're saying is absolutely right. That it does help to meet people. And like I said, it's only been in the last few years that I really feel like I've gotten to know, especially people sort of our generation. I'm just beginning to meet a lot of those people and get to know them. and then it starts to feel more collegial. I mean, it does feel like you start rooting for particular people, as opposed to, having to avert your eyes, after you read the first graph, cause you're just too scared and ashamed. So I think both things are, both sides of it are true, that there's a benefit to keeping everything as a complete abstraction and just trying to do your work as best as you can, which is for the most part what I've done. But I could imagine that being really plugged into those worlds is also has its comfort.
Yeah, I think there's just so many ways for it to make you feel terrible. Like there's just so much rejection. There's
like
rejection.
Life? Are you talking about life? Just there's so many
ways
for life
to
make
you feel terrible. Life. Let's talk about rejection in life. No, in the process of freelancing is just, it's involves so much rejection that there's lots of ways to go in terms of rolling up into a ball.
Right, and right.
Any kind of human connection you can have with other people who are doing it is always strikes me as being valuable.
And here's a dog. We've got a dog visitor. Hey, Ginger. I do think, I hope at least that some of this is a function of age too. I mean, I think with every career, the more you're going to do it, the more comfortable hopefully you'll feel doing it. And I don't, I don't mind. I think that's also part of what makes it exciting, is that I still feel like every time that I go to do a story, I approach it as if I just really don't know much about what I'm doing, and that I have to figure it out. And that's what makes it really thrilling. I mean, I never presume to think that the way that I do reporting and writing is the best way. And in fact, I do the opposite. I presume that I'm doing it in some horribly inefficient way. And if only I could unlock the secret of Evan Ratliff, and then I would, I'd get it all done much faster and it wouldn't be so terrible.
I always assumed that the people that went to journalism school knew a bunch of stuff that I didn't know.
No, they don't really teach you that. I mean, I think that the real benefit of journalism school is just getting to talk to more writers and more established writers. And then you collect these monologues of these people that you meet who are talking to you, talking you through their experiences, how they did a particular story. And you just collect all these things and then you can draw on them when you need to. Oh, this is kind of, I'm facing a situation that's kind of like this situation that so-and-so faced, or at least it gives you a sense that problems are inevitable, and you can work around them. And I'm starting to see in some reporting, I think the book had a lot to do with it, of just having to do so much reporting, just day after day after day. I'm starting to see some excitement in that too, and not just worry, some excitement in that. If I just kind of assume it's going to work out one way or another, it can be a real fun adventure to find the path from here to there. Hopefully just as you do more, that excitement starts to outweigh the horror of messing up.
I'm Evan Ratliff. This has been the Longform Podcast. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from longform.org. You can find them at www.longform.org. And I'm with the Atavist. You can find us at atavist.com. Our editor is Lauren Kirshner. And special thanks to Doug McGray for setting up the audio on the far end of this interview. And thanks to John Muallam for participating. And you know I'll be around. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.